Good evening, everyone. Well, I'd like to start tonight by saying that, I've been practicing Zen for a long time. I missed out on an important opportunity, which was to practice with the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, Suzuki Roshi. And I could have done had I been more precocious, because I actually lived in the Bay Area at the time. He was still living in San Francisco, and I was just across the bay in Berkeley. But I was not more precocious at that time. I wasn't ready for Zen. And so I missed out on that. But then as I did get involved in Zen practice, I did get to know and practice with a number of his, that is Suzuki Roshi's direct disciples. Including his immediate successor, Richard Baker Roshi, and quite a few others. The number of those people who are still with us is actually diminishing. One of the people I'd like to mention tonight is Blanche Hartman, and a story that she used to like to tell about, herself about an interaction she had with Suzuki Roshi early in her practice. Blanche was there at Zen Center when I got there, and she was a presence, you know, up to her death a few years ago, including becoming abbot, ultimately, of San Francisco Zen Center. And she had a lot of stories that she liked to tell about Suzuki Roshi, and one of them that has stuck with me is of her going to speak with Suzuki Roshi at a time when she really thought she was really getting a handle on what Zazen practice was. And she was excited to sit, you know, to go to Suzuki Roshi and tell him that, you know, she was no longer in a muddle about Zazen practice, and that she had penetrated the heart of sitting meditation. And she was excited to go tell him this. And when she did so in practice discussion, or Dokusan as we call it, he immediately responded rather sternly and said something like, "Don't ever say you know what Zazen is." And then he followed with something like, "Only Zazen sits Zazen," or "Only Zazen knows Zazen." Something like that. So, you know, this is a story that she liked to tell on herself to show, you know, kind of who Suzuki Roshi was and who she was at that time, and to teach us something about what Zazen practice is and isn't. You know, it's natural enough for a person who encounters this practice to want to master it, to want to know it, to want to penetrate the heart of Zazen. That's a natural enough thing. And we kind of abet this kind of rational approach, like there's something here to do, some practice here to do, and we tell you how to do it. You know, we tell you how to sit upright. We give you all the usual instructions for our sitting posture. We give you instructions about how to work with breath, how to be at ease in the breath. And we give instructions about how to work with the mind in Zazen. So we give you, you know, we give you a lot of instructions, and usually, you know, when we get instructions, we think, well, if I do these instructions, you know, just right, then I will be able to find out. I will be able to know what this Zazen is, and I will be able to master it. And so in a sense, you know, we set you off on the wrong foot, you know, giving lots of instructions as if those instructions are what the heart of Zazen is. I think Doralee said something like at the beginning, in, you know, with our meditation instructions, he said something like, our Zazen's like a boat, or, you know, it's like a boat. And it is actually a quote that Dogen has about a boat. Maybe I'll say that later in my talk. But she mentioned something about unmoored. So, you know, that there's this boat, this solid thing, and then there's something about setting it adrift, not knowing just exactly where it's going to go, not trying to control it, not exactly trying to send it or know what direction that boat is going to go in. But still, you know, we have this boat called the body mind, and how do we let go of the boat in the midst of being in the boat? So this is some kind of a question that people have to find a response to in their sitting practice. So I thought that Suzuki Roshi's objecting to Blanche's declaration of having his response to her declaration of having a handle on what Zazen is, his response was very much like Dogen's in the Genjo Koan, where Dogen says, "Do not suppose that what you realize becomes your knowledge and is grasped by your consciousness. Do not suppose that what you realize becomes your knowledge and is grasped by your consciousness." So many people devote themselves to Zazen, but Zazen is always pointing to a place beyond the boundary of Zazen, beyond the edge of Zazen. So we devote ourselves to Zazen in a sense to entirely let go of all of our ideas about Zazen. all of our imaginations about what it is. And I think actually that this is, even though it sounds like, oh my gosh, you know, how can I can do this practice and I follow all the instructions, but that's not really what they're talking about. That's not really the point. Following all the instructions isn't the point. It's going beyond the instructions. It's the point. Well, where is that? But I think it should actually come as kind of a kind of relief to us to hear that Zazen is going beyond Zazen, going beyond, as it says, I think also Dogen says, going beyond the boundary of awakening. It says somewhere, you immediately leap beyond the boundary of awakening. But I think to hearing this should come as kind of should actually help us relax. Because it's like, the analogy I came up with was, it's like getting in a car with Buddha and handing the keys to Buddha and say, please, would you drive? Would you please drive this boat or this car? I'll just ride. I'm just going to ride, and I'm going to let Buddha do the driving. And if we think of our practice this way, we think of our practice as riding, not driving to some particular fixed destination, then I think that's very relaxing. And that's very easeful for us. Now, if you're riding along, in your Zazen and you get distracted and you forget that, you know, you're in the Buddha vehicle, you know, with Buddha driving the boat or the car. If you forget that, then, you know, you should come back to the instructions. If you get distracted and forget who you're riding with, then you should come back to the instructions. You should come back to your upright posture and your breath. Your sense of presence. But remembering that you're not in charge of Zazen, I think is quite easeful to remember that. It's like the Buddha vehicle is a self-driving car, right? We have these now, self-driving cars. You just get in the car and, you know, the car takes you. The car takes you. It's not, you know, entirely passive. It's not like, you know, that the practice is completely passive. Far from it. But we do have to bring ourselves, you know. We have to bring ourselves to the event. We have to bring ourselves to the place where this wonderful Buddha vehicle is going to pick us up and drive us home. So, you know, it's a two-pronged event, if you will, bringing yourself to it and letting go of it. So this is pretty, you know, I guess basic, kind of Zazen instruction, or kind of what is the right attitude to have as we approach our sitting meditation. I remember when I decided to go live at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, I got a ride to join the winter practice period at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, and I was with someone who was driving the car and I was riding. And I remember that we got to a place that's called, for those who might know, Tassajara is a place called Line Point. And at Line Point, you can finally see, after going over a long dirt road for about, by that point, about 12 miles, you can finally see your destination. You can finally see the bottom of the valley where Tassajara Zen Mountain Center is located. And so we stopped there. And I guess it's kind of a traditional place to stop for new, you know, to let the new students see where they're going and fully contemplate that they're not going to be leaving for quite a long time. And I remember getting out of the car and looking down into the valley, and this great sense of spontaneous joy arose in me, looking down into the valley. And I didn't immediately know why that was, but as I look back on it, I think it was because I knew I was going into a life that I didn't have to have this, so much of this sense of driving my life. I was just joining the monastic life, and it was going to carry me. And I had this sense of like joy about the idea of just joining a life where I would be carried along, where I would be held and carried, and almost as a, like a, you know, if I was floating down a stream. And a great kind of joy arose in me about this. And I was talking to somebody recently who said much the same thing. This person had had a year living in a Christian brother's monastery. And he expressed, you know, very much, you know, that same sense of kind of ease and relief at joining a life that didn't require so much agency, you know. I mean, it's tricky to talk about because you definitely want to bring yourself to this life. It's not like, you know, it's not like just a passive experience, but also there's this sense of ease in just submitting to the discipline of that life. And what I'm trying to talk about is the joy and the ease of submitting to the discipline of sitting meditation every time that we go, you know, to our cushion. We have a chance, we have an opportunity to submit ourselves to our greater life, our larger life, our life that we don't you know, have to be in charge with or making a lot of decisions about. And that's joyful. That's a joyful practice. When we can just have that kind of approach and that kind of letting go. When we, you know, each time that we go to our cushion, it's like entering the monastery. It's just like that. It's just like, here's, you know, half an hour, here's 40 minutes, here's an hour. To not request a thing from yourself, not request anything, not required to do, you know, to perform, to do anything. And when we give that to ourselves, it's extremely nurturing, you know. Extremely healing to do that practice. So, yeah, so this is, I was going to actually talk about Dogen's analogy with the boat. I think, you know, Dorley and I did not coordinate tonight, but she managed to bring up the boat, which I was also going to bring up. And this is in a fascicle of the Shobo Genzo by Dogen called Undivided Activity. He writes life. He says birth, but I think life for us is a better modern day translation. Life is just like riding in a boat. You raise the sails and row with the oar. So that's the active part of our practice, right? You raise the sail and, you know, this is, you do. You follow the instructions. You sit upright. You regulate your breathing. You calm the cognitive activity of your mind. You raise the sail and row with the oars. That's the active part. That's the active part of our practice. But then he says, although you row, the boat gives you a ride. And without the boat, no one could ride. But you ride in the boat, and your riding makes the boat what it is. Investigate a moment such as this. Your writing makes the boat what it is. This is the meeting. There's so many meetings, you know, we talk about, but this is like the one example of arrow points meeting, you know. Your activity, the Buddha's activity, meeting. And the way you ride in the boat makes the boat what it is. The way you ride in your life makes your life what it is. But the boat is giving you a ride. So, you know, we're not in charge. The boat's not in charge. Together, something is manifesting. Something is manifesting by the activity of the boat and by our activity. And this, to be aware of this and to enjoy this and appreciate it very much is, you know, to have a life of easeful and joyful practice. So there's a sense that the effort you make in practice is being received and carried by life and carried by the Dharma. And this is sometimes called marvelous functioning. Marvelous functioning. And it occurs both on and off the cushion. This marvelous functioning occurs both on and off the cushion. And there are many good stories about this kind of receiving your life and being carried by your life and actualizing your life in the boat of Dharma. So I have a story. I want to tell, a recent story that occurred right here in Sacramento, California. In fact, right in the vicinity of my house. This story of marvelous functioning. The main agent of this story is my wife, Karen, and I have permission to tell this story. So I just want to be clear about that. Since Karen is a member of the Sangha, it's important to ask permission from anybody you tell a story about. And so I asked permission and was granted. So I'm going to tell you this story, which I have a little minor role, but I'll tell you the story. So a little preface to the story. In January, I was participating in the January intensive at Green Gulch Farm, which was, for the first time in 25 years, an online event, of course, led by Reb Anderson. And the theme of the intensive was the Lotus Sutra. And the wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra, which is usually called, commonly called, abbreviatedly called the Lotus Sutra. And Karen didn't enroll in the intensive, but because I was participating in it, I guess, and because it was kind of in the air, and because it seems like a lot of teachers have lately been talking about the Lotus Sutra, Karen decided to listen to on some audio podcasts of Norman Fisher, who gave, I don't know, 18 lectures or something recently on the Lotus Sutra. And so while I was in the intensive, she took up a practice of walking around the neighborhood with her headphones on and listening to Norman Fisher giving Lotus Sutra talks. So one day she was on one of her Lotus Sutra walks and came across a man who was picking through a garbage can and taking out the contents of the garbage can and throwing it in the street and the sidewalk. And, you know, this is something that is not unheard of in our neighborhood. Something, these kinds of things are around our neighborhood on a regular kind of basis. Various events like this. But in this particular case, rather than, you know, standing back and kind of bemoaning the situation or thinking, oh, how terrible it is that there's such a desperate person going through the garbage can and throwing it onto the street, marvelous functioning allowed a response like this. Karen went up to this person and said, "Can I help you put the garbage back in the garbage can?" And the fellow said, "Yes, you can." And so together they put the garbage back in the garbage can. And then she noticed while they were doing that, that this fellow had no shoes. That what he had for shoes, what he was wearing for shoes, were two plastic bags tied around his feet. apparently no socks, no shoes, just two plastic bags around his feet. So she didn't, I guess, say anything to him about that, but she came home, which this event didn't occur too far away. She came home and said, "Do you have any old shoes that we can give to this fellow up the street?" I said, "Yeah, I think I do." So I got a pair of shoes and some socks, and she took them up. And I said, "I don't know if they're going to fit this fellow," but she took them up and gave them to him. And he took off his plastic bags off his feet and put on the socks and put on the shoes. And the shoes did fit. So this was kind of, I was really happy I could play a little role in this wonderful story by giving away a pair of shoes. And I thought, you know, Oscar likes to quote Dogen this saying this. I've heard him quote Dogen saying this a few times, and I like to quote Dogen a lot too. And there's one place where Dogen says, I think also in the Genjo Koan, when Dharma completely fills your body and mind, you realize something is missing. When Dharma completely fills your body and mind, you realize something is missing. So, you know, Karen and I was studying the Lotus Sutra too. You know, we were both studying the Lotus Sutra. So Dharma was kind of, you know, it was kind of filling up body and mind at that time. And, you know, Karen realized something was missing, like this guy's shoes. So, you know, she was able to ask me if I had a pair of shoes, and then she was able to go give them to this fellow. But we don't necessarily always respond that way. So I think, you know, this seemed to me to be just a great example of this marvelous functioning of Dharma study that takes us beyond ourselves, beyond, you know, limited views that we have of, well, and allows us to extend this Dharma beyond, you know, our limited selves, allows us to extend it to others. And so it's on the basis of this Dharma study, this Dharma immersion, that enables us to go beyond the boundary, the usual boundaries, you know, that we set. So I was pretty happy about that whole event. I thought it was such a marvelous event, and I wish there were, I know there are many other events like this. I know maybe in our question and answer, or just, you know, comment period, you could tell some stories about this kind of marvelous functioning. I know there's some marvelous functioning going on in this Sangha, and you know, going beyond usual boundaries on the strength of, you know, our sitting practice and our Dharma study. And so I'd love to hear other stories like this.
I had something similar, but not so similar. It was marvelous, for one thing, that Doralee was leading us into the meditation about the boats, and here you are talking about boats. So that was kind of marvelous functioning in one. But when I had a pair of shoes that I wanted to get rid of, and I knew this one homeless person was out there on this corner every day. And when I went out there, sure enough, not there. And what I was thinking with Karen's story, that person without the shoes and the plastic bag, he was just as much in the Dharma as anyone. But this other person who I came out to give him the shoes was not necessarily in the Dharma. So you can never know who is in or out of that marvelous functioning.
Right. Can never know who's in or out. Sarah.
Thank you, Jim. You know, I loved your story, and or not your story, but also your description of Zazen and the boat. And I was reminded of the fact that often Zazen is referred to as training. We're training the mind. And I think that is really essential to this segue into it. It's not an end in itself. It is helping us to see these kinds of situations. You know, Karen looked down at this man's feet, and she could have just, you know, you avert your eyes very often when you see a person like that. And I think that's the key thing about Zazen. That is not the Zazen is not the purpose in itself. It's training for being able to see in a new way the suffering and the needs of the world. I mean, that's the Bodhisattva vow. And that's the end point, if there is an end point, is losing ourselves so we see others. But I do have a small story there. Again, it has to do with the garbage. There was a gentleman who was on my street before it got so cold to come and pick up the garbage. And I was out doing my garden in the front, and I said hello to him, and we started talking, and he started saying, oh, you know, this was before the election, you know, Trump has got to win. He's, you know, he's so good for Black people. He's really helped. And I was sort of taken aback at what he was saying. And then I asked him, I said, what is your name? And he said, Abraham. And then he asked me the same, Sarah. And I said, ah, Abraham and Sarah. we immediately connected over the name. And we started talking about some books and things, and this man was well spoken and was well educated, but you know, he had all of the outward appearances of someone. His teeth were in poor repair. His clothing was disheveled, and actually we wound up having conversations over a period of about a month before the weather got too cold. And he started telling me, you know, got to grow food. And there was a real connection there. And what struck me was my first hesitation that I had when I first saw him, you know, going through my garbage to even speak. And then everything that I saw with my eyes was an illusion. A total illusion as we connected as two human beings. And so I started putting my recycles out in a plastic bag next to my garbage so he wouldn't have to go through the garbage anymore. But I really appreciate your talk about Zazen, but it's like, what is the purpose of Zazen? It's training so we can see these kinds of situations. We're training our mind to be able to see beyond what are our impressions of what a person is.
Oh, let's see. Brendan has his looks hand like up. Richard and Brendan have. Oh, Oscar, now I see a bunch of hands.
I think Oscar and Brendan was first.
Okay.
I remember seeing their hand first.
What did you say, Oscar?
I think Brendan was first.
Okay.
Thank you. I wanted to comment. This kind of just continues from what Sarah was talking about. You know, I often in the past, I've been, you know, saddened to experience different states of mind, and one day, you know, feeling no hesitation, being able to see a feeling compassion, and but then also being able to see a route towards helping somebody. But then other days, just walking past people who are suffering, most days really, and wondering, you know, what is it? What is the difference? And kind of a cynical view, which at times I've held, was this idea that the person I truly am is the person who just walks by without caring. And it's really just when I'm feeling just inflated or when it feels good inside to help somebody that I do so. But I've come to feel that it really is a difference of states of mind. And I've come to experience how the Dharma and how practice can create that, exactly what you've been talking about, Jim, you know, that it's not just a desire it's not just temporary or just a wave. It is something that can really be experienced and brought into your life more often. And I found myself thinking a lot about the hindrances and how they pop up and create those obstacles when otherwise, and then there's just certain days when they're not there, the fear and the hindrances are not there, and you just are able to act and be compassionate and be of assistance. So that's just what I've been kind of thinking about. So thank you for your talk.
Yeah, it's so mysterious, isn't it? Why, you know, and how that sense of overflowing and having enough for ourselves and others can kind of come and go, you know, and it's kind of mysterious why, but I think maybe the compassionate thing is if it's not there, if it's not there, then as you say, maybe the appropriate response at that time is just walk on by if it's not there. And if it is there, then don't ignore it. But we do want to, you know, kind of come from a genuine place, you know, and I think that's important to come from genuineness.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's, I think the worst occasions is when, you know, I'm feeling small or I'm feeling depressed or fearful, and that just becomes how I relate to other people.
Yeah. Oscar, you next.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for your lovely talk, wonderful talk tonight. I really enjoyed it. I'm enjoying it. So I had an experience recently this weekend about that came to mind when I heard marvelous functioning of how things work. I listened to a wonderful Dharma talk on Saturday from City Center by Jiryu, and it was a Valentine's Day story about the Brahma Viharas, and in a nutshell, it was about softening the heart. And that stayed with me. And I thought about that. And I remembered that I'm not always so in tune with my heart, and that I don't always listen to my heart, and don't know whether it's hard or soft even. And also I had some personal experiences talking with people during the day, one thing and another. And somehow out of that came a realization that everything there is, everything in the whole universe, is a personal experience, is my personal experience, that I don't know anything except my personal experience from moment to moment. And so that's what I had better take care of. And I wanted to share that the next day with Reb Anderson, because he was speaking on Sunday, on actual Valentine's Day. And lo and behold, his talk was about the very same thing, not about softening the heart, not about Valentine's Day, not about Brahma, the heroes, but about the interplay between the person, the completely personal, what I had tuned into, and the fact that everything is working together and there is no personal, there is no self that's identifiable except in the context of everything else. So I wanted to tell him about my story, and I did, but then I had to tell him, but you know, as I was thinking about how I would present this during the Q&As of the lecture, I got submerged in the things of the world. I got sucked out of, so to speak, my groundedness in realizing that that everything is my experience and I'm responsible for it. And he was nodding, and he understood that. And then I said, but I know how to deal with it. It's to practice with the paramitas and avoid getting sucked out of myself that way. And he shook his head, and I said, what? And he said, it's not to avoid anything. It's not to avoid anything. And I felt this wonderful give and take where, you know, Reb and I were, he was the boat and I was riding, and then I was the boat and he was riding. And it all had to do with this story about softening the heart and about everything being my experience all the time. And I felt perhaps the wonderful way that the smile on your face when you said, and the shoes fit. They fit. It all fits together. So thank you very much for sharing that experience.
Thank you, Oscar. Richard.
Yes. I guess, I also say I loved your talk and your analogy with the boat. And also, I guess to ask, because I know you were saying that, you know, sometimes we're in the boat and the boat is just taking us. But I wanted to ask, in like Zazen practice, I know, you know, when you said the boat is taking us, right? I thought of like, sometimes my thoughts and, some people say the monkey mind is taking me, you know, to an island or somewhere else where I don't want to go. And sometimes I think, you know, it's like, oh, I want to stop that boat, turn it around and go back, I guess, to the Zen shore of being present and aware. And then sometimes I'm not even sure, or I'm not even present, that it's taking me for a ride, you know. Before I know it, my thoughts have run their course, and sometimes they're pleasant, sometimes they're not, and then I, you know, come back to the present again. But and I don't know. I think some people would say, or you know, I would say, like, oh, you know, didn't have such a good Zazen today. You know, my mind was all over the place. And then sometimes, you know, I'm thinking like, oh, that's good that I noticed my mind was all over the place. Because sometimes I notice, like, even when I'm not in Zazen, whether, you know, maybe I'm at work or someone is talking to me, I'm trying to pay attention. And then there's that moment where I think, oh, I'm not really paying attention. So I don't know. Your analogy reminded me of that. But I also wanted to say, like, what are your thoughts on, you know, I guess when you're not on that Dharma boat, but maybe you're on that other consciousness boat, you know, on like how you should respond to that, or you know, just yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you for that good question. The quote is, you know, life is, or birth is just like a boat. You raise the sail and row with the oar. You know, so that's the first part. So the first part is you raise the sail. And so that's the part where you say, hey, I'm kind of drifting here. You know, I'm kind of not. I'm not mindful. So that's the part of practice where you come back to the basic instructions, right? You come back to posture, you come back to your breath, you come back to, you know, your the work doing, you know, this is the effort you make. You raise the sail and row. That's a integral part of practice. And, you know, but without the boat, you couldn't ride, and your effort makes the boat what it is. You know, mm-hmm. so it's like you are carried by practice, but you're carried, I don't want to say in proportion to, but you're carried on the back of your own effort too. Mm-hmm. You know, so. I think you're right on in understanding that if you're drifting all around, unmindful, thinking about other things in your day, when you're sitting, then the appropriate response is to come back to those basic instructions. And then once you're, you know, back, you can open up to that broader awareness again, you know, but, you know, it's sometimes just a practice of returning and then opening and returning and opening. And if you can't stay open without drifting around, then just keep returning, you know, keep returning to body awareness, posture awareness. That's so important. And mudra, you know, just really mindful. What's your mudra doing? You know, is it collapsed? Are you pressing your thumbs together? You know, really, you know, that mudra is such a wonderful mindfulness, you know, focus for us. But, you know, in the midst of daily activity to do this, that's where our practice starts to leak over into, you know, daily life. And we can come back to ourselves even in the midst of, you know, chaotic, you know, events.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. And Del.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to say how nice the synchronicity was, I thought, of the boats. That it was just really wonderful that you were both thinking of boats and you had that metaphor to bring to the discussion. But I also wanted to say that I live near Safeway. I could easily walk to Safeway on Alhambra. And there are always homeless people there. So I don't go to Safeway unless I'm planning on giving money to people. I mean, it's just kind of the least I feel like I can do, but I do have some criteria because I, as a woman, would be really frightened being homeless. I give to women first, especially older women, but not necessarily. I also give to people of color, especially older people of color, but not necessarily. Because I figure, you know, they bear a greater burden than anybody white does, but maybe not. But I don't always follow those. It just depends on the person and how I feel, you know. But if I don't, but there's always somebody there. But if I don't see somebody I feel drawn to for some reason, then I don't necessarily, you know, feel like I have to do anything. So, and I can just walk by. But it makes it easier. It just makes it easier to think, you know, Of course, the other day I was going somewhere and I was at the stop sign by my house, and there was this guy in a hoodie and he was pushing the shopping cart, and he was pushing it toward me, and then he turned away from me, but and he kind of started going across the street, and then he turned the other way and he started going not back but kind of diagonal, and it was obvious the shopping cart wasn't really working, and I just kind of watched him, and you know, he didn't look that good, and I thought, okay, Jill, go give him some money. So I drive up next to him and I bring the window down and I, you know, hand him some money. And I said, would you like this? And, you know, he was this very young man, again, a person of color. And his face just lit up. His face just absolutely lit up. And he said, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And the interesting thing about him was that his English was absolutely perfect. And, you know, he was nice looking. And I thought, how did he end up here? I just couldn't help thinking that, because I don't know, it didn't seem like there should be any reason for him to be homeless, really. You know, he seemed like a, for that moment, at least, and our interaction, I felt like he was this perfectly okay kid. And I just, you know, I was really glad that I just kind of watched and then said, okay, well, see what you can do. And I don't know how people use the money. I kind of don't care. And I don't even know how possible it is for them to shop. I know for some of them it is, because I know a couple of people pretty well that I always give money to, and I've known them for a long time. But yeah, so that just makes it a little easier for me. I don't have to think about how I feel very much. So that was my, that's just what I wanted to say. Thank you. And thank you for your talk, Jim. And thank you, Dora Lee, for greeting. And thank you, Oscar, for being our Doe on.
Thank you, Dill. Barry.
The stories you guys were telling made me think of something that happened to me once. I used to work downtown a long time ago, like 15 years ago or something. And I'd always walk through the, I don't even remember what park it is now, but I'd walk from Midtown to downtown. And they were having some sort of festival, like food, like different restaurants, like set up these tents or something. And I was walking by and this guy asked me for money. It kind of smelled like booze a little bit. I thought I could give him money, but then he just buy beer. Like, maybe I'm like, well, can I just buy you a meal? He's like, sure. Great. So we went into this like little food festival place and I'm like, you know, get whatever you want. It's my treat, you know? So you got this big bowl of like curry and noodles and stuff. And I'm like, do you mind if I join you? He's like, sure. And so we sat down and we're eating and it's kind of awkward silence. And then he's like, you know, I think I might have to kill the governor. Oh my God. Like, I guess kind of like what the point of the story was, like I'd done the story in my head, like, you know, I'm like such a good person and I'm buying this guy this food and we're going to connect. And, you know, I was like, I just had this like narrative in my head about how wonderful this experience was going to be. And it just, I'm like, and he's like, I think I'm gonna have to kill the governor. And I'm like, you know, I really wanted to get up and leave, but I'm like, why are you going to kill the governor? And then you start talking about UFOs or something. He was clearly like schizophrenic or something, but I just thought it was so funny that I had this vision of, you know, me, you know, wonderful me giving, and then we're going to like connect as humans. And it just went off the rails really quickly. I'm not even sure I have a point. It was just kind of an interesting story.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you know, what I'm thinking is that, you know, if we're going to go into these kinds of situations where, you know, it's not necessarily clear what to do, it's helpful to be studying Dharma as you enter these situations. So, you know, you could, if you were studying, for instance, the story of Devadatta who tried to kill the Buddha, you could bring that up, you know, and you could say, well, you know, I'm a Buddhist and the Buddha, did you know the Buddha had a brother and he tried to kill the Buddha, but then later he actually became the Buddha's disciple? So, you know, there's possibilities of bringing Dharma to these situations. And I think that would, you know, I'm just suggesting that when you get in that kind of situation, maybe there's some Dharma story that you can bring to it that would surprise and enlighten the, you know, person who wants to do harm. Or the person who is begging, either, too. So, this is, I think, the point of the story I told about Karen, how, you know, it just seemed to be, you know, it seemed to arise on the back of Dharma study. You know, it seemed to rise on the wave of Dharma study. Maybe it doesn't always happen that way, but it can't hurt. I think Rainey, I'm sorry, I didn't see you before. Your hand was very pale.
Hi. Thank you so much for the talk. I really appreciated it. And I felt like it was actually a very useful, like, teaching for me to get right now. And I don't really have a point with this perspective, but I just kind of wanted to offer that, you know, you know, I'm a woman and I'm an avid runner, and I've had a lot of experiences with men on the streets in cities where often homeless men will confront me or grab me or block my way or shout things at me. And this has been, it is so hard, so hard for me to even like find within myself the compassion that you're talking about. And it's something I have thought about and struggled. It has been a place where I have felt myself hardening in my heart in a way that I don't like. And I think there's a sense of powerlessness I have, but also a sense of wanting to protect myself, right? And it has affected how I interact in the world and where I run and how I see people, including people who have done nothing to me, because I've had these other experiences that were so awful. And so it's really, it's funny because I had this amazing meditation practice this morning where I was really focused on feeling the interconnectedness of all beings. And then I got to this meditation session this evening, and we start immediately talking. And I was like, there are some beings that I have not felt the internet connected with, interconnection with, because I've had these pretty lousy experiences. And so I guess I wanted to offer that kind of slightly different perspective and say that in some ways, I think this is like, you know, a very useful talk for me this evening. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. I think we should have one more comment. I see Meg's, maybe we'll make that the last comment or question. Or
I just wanted to thank you, Jim. Such a very special talk about cutting, as Doralee said, you know, cutting the ties of the boat, letting it go. And I have found each morning as I sit my morning Zazen, I've come up with a little thing that I say about kind of setting my intention for my Zazen. But one of the things that I refer to in that is, in the three pure precepts, the last one, as I vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. And I feel like the being lived is letting the boat go and letting the Dharma take it where it, and the Buddha take it where it needs to go. And that's that's what I pray for. That's what I want somehow is to be lived for a greater good. And the whole imagery of what you talked today and Karen's story was just, I found myself writing and underlining things, and the whole image of the car, hand the keys to Buddha, you know, to be lived by the Buddha, to be guided, directed, to see the world differently. It's just such a powerful talk, and just so helpful. I just thank you. And Rainey, I so hear, you know, I don't go for a walk by myself for those very reasons. So, interesting world we live in. Yeah, thanks. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Meg. I see Karen's hand, and I, since I've talked with about her, I must recognize her and allow her words.
Well, I won't say much, but I did want to, I mean, since I was in the story, feel like I should say something that that action that I took that day, it was a particular situation. This fellow seemed perfectly harmless, and he was arranging things almost like an altar on this ledge. And it, in other words, there was just something that, and then the plastic bags had holes in them, and his feet were bleeding, and it was cold outside, and there were just these, I mean, often I would have probably walked across the street. You know, maybe the listening to Norman's lectures did have an influence for me that day. And I really did feel some urgency about it. I didn't have any doubts about it. In some many other situations, I would not have done that. So I just wanted to make that clear. But also, I remember talking to Reb Anderson one time about a situation where I really did want to intercede in a situation that was bordering on being violent, and I didn't, because it didn't seem safe. And he said, you know, in that situation, probably you were not the person, you couldn't be the bodhisattva in that situation. You just weren't the right tool. And it probably needed to be, you know, another man with a big truck or something to take care of that situation in the appropriate way. So anyway, I just wanted to make that clear. And anyway, thank you.
Thank you for your appropriate response, Karen.
Well, Dogen says somewhere too that, you know, 99, I think he says, 99 times out of 100, we miss the mark. But that one time that we hit it, we usually remember. And maybe we can teach from that place and give from that place. Thank you so much.